Father, you have given us so much to learn and grow and to avoid the pitfalls and the dangers and the poison of sin and to experience the joy and the beauty of righteousness. You have given us your word, you have given us one another, you have given us teaching from wise and godly men and women of the past. And yet there is an impenetrable wall that is possibly in between these great gifts and all that we long for, and that is our hard hearts, Father. In light of that, would you please do what we cannot do and soften our hearts, Lord. Soften my heart first and foremost to your leading. Let not stubbornness and adherence to what I have planned overrule and grieve your spirit. For those here, Father, who are prone to self-condemnation, would you bring comfort to those who are prone to self-justification? Would you awaken and soften? We ask these things, and for everything in your heart that you desire to do would be done today in Jesus' name. Amen. Thomas, I want you to call me Rocky. But your name is Kevin. Yes, but I've decided my new nickname is Rocky. So you can call me Rocky. Now, the details of this thing that's happened to me in the past are a bit fuzzy and some fictional, but I have had the experience of someone telling me they have chosen for themselves a new nickname. And I'm not talking about if you come from China and you choose a name. I'm not talking about that kind of silliness, that legitimate thing. I'm talking about a Canadian, grew up in Canada, decided, I don't like my name anymore. This is my new nickname. Everybody call me this from now on. And now they're asking me to do the hard work of overcoming the habit. If you've ever experienced somebody even changing their name a little bit, it's a lot of work to now call them this new name. And it was also really awkward and painful. Picture yourself standing there. My name is Rocky. And he's like, hey, Kevin, can you pass the... Rocky. Hey, Rocky, can you pass the salt? It's super awkward. It's super painful. But why is that? Why is that? And I'm not here to dig into the depths of the human psyche, but I think one of the reasons is because we inherently know that a name is to be received, not taken for yourself. When we are born, we are given a name. When we grow, we receive names as we grow. A lot of them maybe not names we would have chosen for ourselves. Some of them intended to shame or hurt us. But we also may be given names that carry honor with them. Think about the fact also that being given a name or one's name can be equivalent to your reputation. You have a good name. What does that mean? You have a good reputation. Do you get that for yourself through your own effort? Certainly you can make choices that lead to that. But by and large, it is something you receive. Is your name associated with integrity, courage, kindness, or laziness, selfishness, or cowardice? Now, the Bible teaches wanting a good name is a good desire. Proverbs 21:1 says, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. But how do we go about getting a good name? As I said, there are things we can do. But one of the things that we have to remember is underneath all the efforts we might undertake to get a good name, it is God who bestows a good and lasting name upon us. It cannot be earned. Now, there are two main buckets that we could categorize the rebellious reaction to that reality. Number one, you can say to yourself, if I can't control my reputation, then why should I even bother trying? I am just going to live life by my indulgences. If it suits me to lie over here or cheat over here, I'll do it. Right? All that being honest, it never really leads to a good reputation. Somebody's going to slander me anyway, so why even bother? I'm just going to indulge myself. That's one. That's one sinful, rebellious response to the fact that only God gives a good name. The other one is, I'll show you, God. I will get my good name. You will see. They're both sinful and rebellious responses to the truth that God is the one who ultimately bestows a good name. And there is one correct response. I will seek a good name by faith and obedience to God, waiting for his way and his time to bestow upon me the good name I desire. I will receive from God rather than take for myself. Now, this leads to my main proposition for today, which is, because of the deceptive nature of evil, we must allow God's promises to shape all we are and do. Because of the deceptive nature of evil, we must allow God's promises to shape all we are and do. We have 3 points underneath that. Because the world appears impressive, we must live by faith. Number two, because self-exaltation is seductive, we must be strategic. And point number three, because God's care is inconspicuous, we must be attentive. Point number one, because the world appears impressive, we must live by faith. Now, since we did not have a chance to read through chapter 10, I really need everyone to have their Bibles open to Genesis chapter 10 here this morning. For the first main point, we're going to go all of chapter 10, the genealogy, or in the Hebrew, the toledot. The toledot, I'll use that word, I'm not trying to be presumptuous. Toledot is a word that doesn't quite translate to English. It can mean genealogy, it can mean generations, it can mean family history. I invite you to dig into that, but I'm going to use that word interchangeably with genealogy and these kinds of things today. To dig deeper into chapter 10, what I need us also to do is to try to think of yourself in the shoes of ancient Israel. There's a period I think this text applies to, but we're going to pretend that we're ancient Israel on the cusp of the promised land, the second attempt. Remember the first attempt back in Exodus? The people were told to take the promised land of Canaan, but they backed off in fear. They were too scared. They wouldn't do it. And now they have all died. That generation has died. This is the second generation. You're about to go into the promised land. This is an important lesson on hermeneutics, how to read the Bible. Every text is written to someone, but for us. Pastor Tony's going through the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews is written to the Hebrews, for all of God's people. So this is written to the Israelites. Moses, the author, has in mind these people. They're going to march into the promised land, and they have a massive task ahead of them. They have limited weapons. No horses or chariots, no siege works to attack fortified cities, no legacy of battle prowess. They know how to take care of sheep. They know how to make bricks. They don't know anything really about battle. Add to that, the people you are about to fight are bigger and stronger than you are. You have almost nothing but one thing: the promise of Yahweh, the God who roughly 40 years ago overturned the entire civilized world by destroying the international superpower of Egypt. Now, it was an impressive feat, but that was surely just a one-time event back then. Now everything reverts to the normal laws, where the bigger army with the better weapons wins. Isn't that how it goes? This genealogy, I would submit to you, is God saying to his people, no. Things don't revert to normal. The way I work is to use the weak things to shame the strong. I've done it there. I will do it again, and I'm doing it right now. I continue to do it. And I want to show you that that's in this genealogy as well. We need to start back in chapter 9, the text that Pastor Craig expounded for us. It's starting in verse 25. We need to remember the curses spoken by Noah, by God through Noah, I would say. It starts like this. Cursed be Canaan. This is verse 25. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers. He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. So God has pronounced a curse on Ham and his descendants, Canaan, and even Japheth is subordinated to Shem. So now when we flip the page and we go to chapter 10 and we read about the children of Ham and the children of Japheth and the children of Shem, what should we see? We should see Ham doing badly. And we should see Shem doing well and Japheth somewhere in between. But what are we going to see? Let's pay attention to this. Before I start, I'm going to ask you to try and pay attention to two things, all right? The thing I just said, watch for the curse and the blessing. Also, there's going to be allusions to the Tower of Babel. So we're going to try and track two things at the same time. I know you are all really bright. You can do it. Let's do this. First, we're going to look at Japheth. Start in verse 2. The sons of Japheth, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. I am not saying I'm doing all this right, okay? Just so you know, don't use me as a reference. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, Togarmah. The sons of Javan, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. From these, the coastland peoples spread in their lands. There's our first Tower of Babel illusion, all right? Spread in their lands. Each with his own language, by their clans, in their nations. Nothing really of note there. Japheth was supposed to be subordinated to Shem. We don't see anything there, but there's nothing necessarily contradicting what Noah said. But let's keep moving. We're going to Ham. Now, this is where we should start to see some things go bad, shouldn't we? But let's see what's here. The sons of Ham, Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. The sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, Sabtica. The sons of Rama, Sheba, and Dedan. Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. More hints. In the Erech, Akkad, Calna, in the land of Shinar. Again, that's Tower of Babel stuff. From that land he went, dispersed, into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. Now what do we see? Almost the very opposite of what we should expect. What is going on here? Where's the curse? Everything seems to be going great for the sons of Ham. But this is a facade. This is what is being presented. If we look closely, we will see the impending judgment. And the Israelite, the attentive Israelite, would see this in verse 13 and 14. It says, Egypt fathered Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, Naphtuim, Pathrusim, Calusim, from whom the Philistines came, and Kaphtorim. This is what the attentive Israelite would have seen. In the genealogy, Egypt has many sons. But what I just saw 40 years ago showed that that height to which Egypt was lifted has now been brought very, very low. That is what we have to pay attention to. We have signs of strength, signs of glory, signs of prominence. But we also have hints that a coming judgment is around the corner. Now we move on to Canaan. This is where we really should see the curse, right? But again, look for those hints. Let's read it. Verse 15, Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn Heth. Now it's not just individual sons we're talking about, but entire people groups, nations, cultures. Listen, not Jebus, but the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, whole nations. The Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Zemarites, the Hamathites. Afterward, the clans of the Canaanites dispersed, Tower of Babel, right? Hold that. And the territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon, the direction of Gerar, as far as Gazan, the direction of Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboiim, as far as Lasha. These are the sons of Ham by their clans, languages, and lands of languages. One more thing to get the point. Again, the curse, if you just have a surface reading, you're going to go, God, what are you doing? Where's the curse? These guys are doing great. We have a dozen nations. Sorry, I didn't count. We have a bunch of nations coming from Canaan who's supposed to be cursed. But if you read carefully, what do you see? In the direction of Sodom and Gomorrah. That is a place that was utterly destroyed because of their sin and arrogance. We're going to get to the application here. Just hold on to these things. Next, we're going to read Shem. Now, this is where we should see blessing, right? We should see blessing. Verse 21, to Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, children were born, the sons of Shem, Elam, Asher, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram, the sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arpachshad fathered Shelah, and Shelah fathered Eber. To Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. Joktan fathered, here we go, 13 names. Almodad, Shelephas, Hazar, Meveth, Jerah, Hadoram, Uzal, Dikla, Obal, Ibmael, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab. All of these were the sons of Jactan. The territory in which they lived extended from Mesha to the direction of Sepher to the hill country of the east. These are the sons of Shem by their clans, their languages, their lands, and their languages. Two things to note. I have tried to draw your attention to the fact that Moses is giving hints of the Tower of Babel episode and the dispersion of the people. But the only person who actually seems to embrace the work of God by naming his child after that event is the father of Peleg. This is the line of promise. This is the line that trusts and regards God. So that's one thing to note. The second thing to note is Peleg, again, line of promise, has no children in this up to this point. Joktan has 13 children. So there's a, again, it looks like the line of promise is dying. They're dried up, no kids. And his brother is doing great, 13 kids. This is a good thing in this culture. I know it terrifies some of you to have 13 boys. This is a really good thing. No mention of the children of Peleg, and the Israelite has to come with, what's going on with God's promise? They're not working. Somebody needs to kick the Coke machine on God's promises. Nothing's happening. There's no blessing on Shem, and there's no curse on Ham. It looks like the cursed family is with all the power and privilege. The chosen line is dwindling down to nothing, and the enemies of God are growing strong. Will God's people trust his promises? Or will they go, I'm done. I'm done with God and his promises. I'm going with the strong guy. I'm going with the Nimrod and these guys. What will God's people do? Now, I watched an interview of a guy named Chris Bumstead, who has won, okay, get this right, the most classic physique championships in the history of the Mr. Olympia competition. What does that mean? Basically, I'll try and boil it down, he was judged to have the most impressive, balanced, and attractive physique in the world 6 years in a row. So in this interview, he was asked, okay, Mr. Sexiest Man Alive, whatever, about what percentage of your direct messages are from women and about what percentage are from men? I'm going to actually give you a second. You have the most attractive body in the world. What percentage of your direct messages would be from women and what from men? You know what he said? 90% from guys. I was surprised. Maybe you're not surprised, but I was surprised. And maybe I shouldn't be, right? Who watches pro wrestling with all the guys with their shirts off and the oily bodies and all that? Is that all women that are watching that? No. Who watches UFC with guys dominating each other with strength, pounding them into the ground? Is that women? No. It's men. We rightly identify the problem that men are physical, they're attracted to physical stuff, and we maybe are more persuaded by the physical attractiveness of women rather than their character, and that is a problem. That is a problem. But sometimes we neglect the fact that guys have a real problem with being attracted to the appearance of power and glory without the inner glory and power of someone like our Savior, for example, Jesus Christ. We're attracted to powerful cars. Like I said, pro wrestling. We want the hacks, right? How do you get to be buff? How do you get to be the top of your company? How do you get to be a level 1,000 knight in World of Warcraft? I don't even know what it is anymore, okay? I'm way out of touch with that stuff. I shouldn't have even tried. We as men are very attracted to the appearance of power and care far too little about true power and glory and strength. And this was the threat to Israel. All the other nations, strong. Nimrod, mighty hunter before the Lord. He's building cities. That city doesn't work out. He goes and he builds another one, and he builds another one. And Israel, the guys that are leading the army are like, oof, I kind of want to be on that guy's team. He seems to be doing pretty good. That's the temptation. But then there's the promises of God for real power and real glory. It's concealed, but it's there, and it's eternal. Now let's think about this for a second. How can we apply this? Well, first of all, for ourselves, right? For men, we need to be careful. Are we spending our time taking in media that stirs up merely the desire for the appearance of power and strength? And then as parents, this is a tough one because kids, especially little boys, they come out of the womb. Give me a sword and show me the bad guys. That's how they come out, at least in my house, anyways. My 3-year-old, sorry, side story, is watching an advertisement, a looping advertisement for condos, and he's just like, when's the bad guy coming? Doesn't know that it's not a show. So we have to be careful of this as we're teaching our kids. Are we just putting beside big, you know, muscly superheroes all the time and WWE, pro wrestling, and UFC, and all that stuff? And I think there's an application here for women and daughters as well, because it affects when you talk about men that you admire and you have an audience of other guys around you. That makes a big difference to them. It makes a big difference. But it's a good desire for power and strength that our boys have, but not just the appearance of power and strength, true power and strength. And this can be particularly hard in our culture, because if you watch the shows right now, what you have is many shows which have these bumbling, incompetent men being rescued by super competent power women. And so what it can feel like is, as fathers and as parents, is just put strong men in front of our boys. We've done. Check the box. We're good parents. We have to go deeper. We have to go deeper. We got to put before the eyes, yes, good examples of godly men. Maybe they don't have the biggest muscles. Maybe they're not great at World of Warcraft or Fortnite or whatever. But they are humble. They are courageous. They're full of faith. And we have to put the promises of God before them. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Something we try to do in our house, we don't do it as often as we would like, is we try to do this little liturgy with our boys. We go, how do we be great today, boys? We be a servant. How do we be first today? We be the slave of everyone. Matthew 20, 26 to 28. That's what Jesus says to his disciples. You guys want to be great? That's good. I have no problem with you guys wanting to be great and powerful. I have no problem with you guys wanting the whole earth. This is how you get there. Meek. Servant. Last. And that's what Shem is in this genealogy. He's last. So just as Israel would have been tempted to put Nimrod in front of them as the hero, we have to be careful. And we can take a lesson from what the name Nimrod means nowadays. I don't know everybody's cultural context, but for most of why I understand, Nimrod is an insult. Nimrod is an insult now, and you know how it got that way? Now, this is a Google search, so take it with a grain of salt. But what the internet said is that Nimrod went from being a respected name to an insult because of the Bugs Bunny and Tweety show. So Bugs Bunny and Tweety, they do little skits. There's an animated rabbit, and he is being hunted by Elmer Fudd. He has a haircut like mine, Elmer Fudd. And he's trying to shoot, and he has a speech impediment, and he's clumsy, and he's incompetent. And Bugs Bunny would call them Nimrod, Mighty Hunter, Nimrod. And now that name has gone to becoming an insult. Do you see how fragile the glory that comes from men is? All it takes is a cartoon rabbit, and that name goes from glory to shame. But the name that is given by God will never be put to shame. So point number one, because the world appears impressive, we must live by faith. Point number two, because self-exaltation is seductive, we must be strategic. Now we're at the Tower of Babel. And we've already seen, there's been hinting all throughout the genealogies. Let me refresh our memory with the gist of the story. All the people of the earth endeavor to build a tower to heaven as an act of pride and rebellion against God. God, not being impressed, has to come down to see the tower. Rather than destroying them for their arrogance, he uses a far more gentle and gracious strategy. He takes the single language and he scatters it and divides them into a multitude of language so cooperation is no longer possible. And this is where the multi-language nature of our world comes from. But we got to dig deeper into this. First, by looking at the illusions that I tried to point out as we went through chapter 10. Back in chapter 10, verse 10, it says, "The beginning of Nimrod's kingdom was at Babel, in the land of Shinar." And 11, verse 2 says, "And the people migrated from the east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there." And then later in verse 9, it says, "And therefore the name is called Babel." We also heard a lot of being dispersed and having their own languages. Verse 5 of chapter 10, people spread. Verse 11, "From that land, the land of Shinar, Nimrod went." Verse 18, "Afterward they dispersed." Verse 25, "The name of the one is Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided." So what this is what Moses is doing. He did the Toledot, the generations. Think of like three columns, three genealogies, right? And he's cutting a cross-section across all three of them and saying, this event happened, and we're going to stop, and we're going to focus on it to draw out a point. And one way to say the point Moses is trying to get is there's been yet another attempt to usurp the throne of God and another judgment. You think of all the attempts to usurp the throne of God in Genesis so far. Genesis 3, Eve tries to bring heavenly wisdom down, and she's judged. Second, this one's a bit more obscure. Genesis 6, the sons of God try to unite heaven and earth by marrying the daughters of men. Heaven and earth, trying to get them together through sexual intimacy, Genesis 6. And there's a judgment, the flood. We have the third attempt. All the people of the earth try to bring heaven and earth together through technology, Genesis 11, and there's a judgment. They're scattered throughout the earth. They don't want to gratefully receive the name God gives them. They want to make a name for themselves. They want to build this tower, this ziggurat, in order to make a name for themselves. And this has already been hinted by the name, by the blessing of Shem. You may not know that Shem in Hebrew is the Hebrew word for name. In other words, Moses is presenting a choice. You can receive a name, a Shem, receive a Shem from God, or make a Shem for yourself. And he also shows the consequences of trying to choose a Shem for yourself. So ultimately, this is about striving to take from God rather than receive. Taking glory from God rather than receiving it. Taking from God the right to come before him rather than receiving it. Taking from God the power to be a gathered people rather than receiving it. Taking a name for yourself rather than receive us. Thus, the presumptuous, proud people are cursed. Rather than having a name of honor, they have a name of shame. Now, this is worth noting. Babel in Babylonian means gate of the gods. Gate of the gods. In Hebrew, much like in English, it means incoherent nonsense. What did your boss say? Oh, he just babbled at me for 30 minutes. Right? Again, we see it. Men try to exalt their names. They're helpless. The honor of your name is in God's hand, and he will do with it what he will. Next. So rather than having a name of honor, they have a name of shame. Rather than being exalted, God has to come down to see what they were doing. Rather than being protected from being scattered, they actually precipitated their scattering. The other thing that makes this episode unique is the means by which they try to take the place of God, through technology. Some of you may see this right away. Some of you I may have to persuade a little bit. There's a large amount of text given to technology here. It's in verse 3. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Now, if Moses just wanted us to say they built a tower, that is all unnecessary. Why do we need to know what they stuck the bricks together with? Why do we need to know that they burned them? It has nothing to do with building a tower. This is way too much detail if Moses just wants us to understand they built a tower. Bricks and mortar may not strike us as technology, but if we start to consider at one time the wheel was technology, that copper and iron were technology, they changed the whole landscape of human history. If you have a metal that can cut through the other guy's metal because it's stronger, What's going to happen to the international world? It's going to change through technology. You know, they're not smartphones, but it's technology. Therefore, the question for us is, do people still try to usurp the place of God through technology? Yes. Yes, we do. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, I believe these attempts to usurp God through technology have more of an active and passive sense to them. You could say type A and type B, maybe, but let's leave it as that. More of an active striving to usurp the place of God and more of a passive one. Let's begin with omnipresence, okay? Only God is everywhere all the time, omnipresent. Only God can be two places at once. But are we not tempted through the use of technology to be more than one place at the same time? We're studying, but we're with our friends. We're watching our kids, but at the same time, we're with the people online. Maybe we're even with our friends online while we're driving. God help us. Maybe we're trying to be present with our spouse while at the same time in the group chat with our family. Only God is omnipresent. Sorry. Only God is omnipresent. And you know what happens? When we try to be two places at once, we end up being nowhere. You can't read what you're on your phone properly. You're giving half-answered questions and things like that, and you think you're understanding what your partner is saying, but you haven't really been listening to them. You're nowhere. Try to be everywhere, you end up being nowhere. It's an attempt to take the place, to take a characteristic of God that belongs to Him alone, omnipresent, and have it for myself. We are finite. We will miss some things, and that's okay. But if you try to be everywhere, you miss everything. One prayer that we might pray when that itch starts to get to us, oh, I'm missing out, I need to be where they are, I can't just be sitting in traffic here and on, could be this. Lord, help me to be the limited creature you created me to be. Help me to be the limited creature you created me to be. Next, let's consider omniscience, knowing everything. Now, I'm certain no one in here would say, oh, I'm almost there, I'm almost knowing everything. But a healthy curiosity or a desire to make sure you do a good job on a project or make the best purchase can lead to huge wastes of time endlessly reading reviews of projects and top 10, what's the best dishwasher out there, and on and on and on the internet. All to avoid something very human, making a mistake. Perhaps you buy the second best product rather than the first best product. I don't even know if that's said right. Maybe buying something slightly more. You could have got the 40% off, but oh, you only got the 30% off. Oh no. I'm speaking to myself, by the way. Like, this is my temptation here. I'm type A. This is my temptation right here that I'm telling to you. I actually asked ChatGPT what my weaknesses are. And it said, maybe you spend too much time deliberating over things. Like, guilty. So there you go. So modern technology can present to us the lie, you can know everything. You can never make a mistake. You never have to get lost. Thanks, Google Maps. You no longer ever make a bad purchase. You're no longer deceived about anything. So you spend way too much time clicking on YouTube videos that said what they don't want you to know about mouthwash. You can use the same prayer as before. Maybe cite the words of John the Baptist, who says in John chapter 1, I am not the Christ. You can't know everything. Here's the point. One of the points I want us to take away. No matter how far you go back, you want to go back 100 years, 200 years, no, it would be better if we didn't have all this technology distracting us. We'd be more godly. We'd be more happy. We'd be all this stuff. You can go back more than 4,000 years, and technology is still an issue. But it's not technology, right? It's the sin in our heart. Now, the final, most prevalent way we usurp the throne of God is to use technology for our own pleasure first and foremost. This is more of a type B personality issue. In other words, we neglect technology until it delivers pleasure or comfort, effectively saying, we say, all things are for me. my email, my texts, my notifications are primarily so I can get the scoop on the best sale, so I can be in the know, so I can receive affirmations for my posts, so I can feel little dopamine hits throughout the day, so I can appear competent and put together and so on. I don't bother. This person will not bother to take the time to set up your phone, email, and other notifications in order to make sure that I'm serving God and others primarily. Messages from real friends and from the church are indiscernible from junk mail and social media updates. Reminders to pray or memorize scripture, if they're used at all, are drowned out in all manner of interruptions. You may neglect the many ways technology may help you to be more faithful and reliable, and it's just this buzzing nuisance in your pocket, zzz, 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 all the time. Both those who are more like me, type A, who are actively trying to usurp God's place, and those who are more passive need to remind ourselves of the bait and switch of technology. It promises power, pleasure, control, but it delivers enslavement. Do you know the next place we read about bricks and mortar in the Bible? Exodus chapter 1, verse 14. And the Egyptians made the Israelites' lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. It's not easy to set up our technology in a way that it can be used to serve God and others rather than to be a servant. You might be the kind of person that can double down and discipline yourself to get it, but most of us are going to need help. I actually have a couple resources if you want to keep going. Next slide. No, next slide. A couple resources there. If you don't want to take out your phone and take a picture of it, you can email me, all right? So there we go. But those are a couple resources to help dig in. Like, what's going on in our hearts? What is happening as we engage in this technology? But for most of us, we're going to need help, and I would urge you to receive that help if you need it. Here's the key. Let's not be a people who our lives are made bitter through hard service to our technology. Let's serve a good master, Jesus Christ. So point number one, because the world appears impressive, we must live by faith. Point number two, because self-exaltation is seductive, we must be strategic. Point number three, because God's care is inconspicuous, we must be attentive. Now, the last toledot we studied was that of Noah, and in this section we have two toledots, Shem and Terah. It seems like Moses wanted to save the sons of Peleg until this toledot. Remember we said, where's the sons of Peleg? He doesn't have any. Here they are. Here they are. Verse 18, when Peleg had lived 30 years, he fathered Reu. So the line of promise has not died. The continued, ongoing promise of God was concealed for a moment, but here it is, continuing and being cared for. What else we have here is this toledot is not to enumerate where the nations of the earth came from or great cities or accomplishes. I believe the purpose here is to show God's care for the chosen line. Gone from this toledot are accomplishments of men, places they lived, cities they built. The focus is the preservation of the line of promise. With a note of hope, death is not explicitly mentioned in this list. Now, if you remember the formula back in Genesis 5, which you probably don't, Genesis 5 is when Seth lived 105 years, he fathered Enosh. Seth lived after he fathered Enosh 807 years, had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Seth were 912 years. In this little part, and he died. But here, it never puts that little formula, and he died. I'm taking this as a hint that there's a peculiar life at work in this lineage, an expectation of things to come, concealed immortality, if you will. However, despite the notes of hope in this genealogy, the next one we come to suspense and even crisis. Let's read 27 to 32. It's only six verses. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran, three sons again. Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarah was barren. She had no child. Terah took Abraham his son, and Lot the son of Haran his grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, and his son Abram's wife, And they went forth from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. That's where they're headed. But when they came to the land of Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now, what do we see here? We just had a genealogy where death was conspicuously absent. Now we have one where death is front and center. Sarai is barren. The seed that has been so diligently cared for through all these generations is now in danger. Also, Terah's journey to Canaan has been aborted. He set out for Canaan, the promised land that the audience reading his text, remember the Israelites on the cusp of the promised land. Terah was going there, but he got stuck. Same thing that happened to Israel. Interesting. Haran, who died back in Ur, is the name of the new place. You know, it's almost as though Terah chose to let the tragedies of the past define his future. He moves from Ur, the place of his son's death, but he can't get past Haran. The Toledot that gave hints of hidden life now gives way to a new one in which death dominates, a dead son, a dead womb, and a journey that dies in progress. Think back to the original audience of Israel. They have just seen the curse of God concealed by the appearance of strength and prosperity, but never mind, here we go. It's good. The curse is going to happen. They just saw the promise of blessing seems to be failing, but never mind. It's continuing. But now we have a new crisis. We have a new crisis. Will the readers trust the small, subtle ways God works? Or will they turn away from the text in discouragement and disappointment? The state of our culture, which I've alluded to already in this sermon, can be very discouraging for Christians sometimes. I'm just thinking about the church for a second, and we have confusion over gender, stories of people deconstructing their faith, churches that are more interested in proclaiming that they are on Treaty One land than proclaiming the gospel. We have leaders that are falling from grace. We have churches administering lethal injections in their sanctuaries. We have ordaining clergy that live lives of rebellion against God. The list could go on and on. However, if you're listening, God continues to do a work. God continues to care for his promises. Let me give one example. There has been, for the last couple of generations, just an absolute hammering on men. Men, you're the problem. Toxic masculinity. Just know your lane. It's my body, my choice. Like, you have no opinion. On and on and on. But you know what's been showing up in churches? Who's been showing up? Young men. For the first time in like 100 years, more young men have been going to church. And why is that? Because it's the only place that will speak a word of hope to young men. You can have forgiveness. There's no forgiveness in our culture for young men. If you've messed up, you're toxic, you're done. It can say, you're destined, God wants glory for you, not shame. It's the only place that will say that. So what the enemy is doing to destroy and crush and hurt, God is using to draw to himself. God is caring for his church. He has always been doing that. And I wonder where you are here today. Honestly, I hope this point is utterly irrelevant to you. Sounds funny to say, right? But I hope everything's going great. I hope you are full of hope for tomorrow and next week and next month and on and on. But I suspect there are a few who are struggling to see God's care in the midst of hardship, even death. You may even feel that if things do start to go well, then they're just going to turn bad in a minute anyway. Sort of like our text here today. Bad. Hope. Oh, boom. Crashes again. Maybe you feel that way. But I would encourage you, look around the room. The people in this room came from one man, his barren wife, and his nephew. Everybody here can trace their lineage in some way back to those three. God has preserved his seed through all the failures and false starts in Israel. He has preserved his church through the ages. even if coming to church is hard for you, you can still see God keeps his promises. The family that began so small is now millions and millions of people throughout the world. One day, this entire earth will only have people that love and serve Jesus Christ on it. You know that? There will not be a single person on this earth that is in rebellion against God in any way, shape, or form. We must endeavor to be attentive to God's care for us and his faithfulness to his promises, because the clamor of the world can be loud. And if I can offer one word of advice, I'm going long here. Be careful what you take in. Do you watch the news all the time? Just podcasts, shows that are just proclaiming evil is on the rise, evil is on the rise, evil is on the rise, beware. If that's your steady intake, you need to turn that down and you need to insert some God is on his throne, God is on his throne, God is on his throne. It shapes us, what we listen to, what we partake in. It's not just background noise, okay? It's not just background noise. We must resist the cynicism and despair that the world would give to us and carry one another when we falter, because God's promises will come to pass. Now, if you're a Christian here today, you have already received a name. You will have a personal name, I believe. Revelation speaks about that. But you have already received a derivative name that which is more glorious than anything we can imagine. We are named after Christ. Do you call yourself a Christian? Little Christ. You're named after Christ. I wish this landed on me more often. Jesus Christ, the one who possesses the name that is above every name, one of the first things he did was share that name. I want you to have some of it. Now, here's the tricky part. That name will bring you disrespect, even shame, and hardship in this world. But that does not change what it is. It is a glorious name. It is a glorious name. This is the path to Christ, to glory, sorry, and Christ, to patiently endure the shame of this age for the joy of being the Christ. The question is, will we indulge the active or passive means of taking a name for ourselves, or will we wait? Will we wait for him to lift us up? If you're not a Christian here today, you have thus far lived a life of lifting yourself up, of taking a name for yourself. It may not feel that way, but when you ignore Jesus Christ, you have implicitly said, I have my own name, and that is enough. And I need to tell you, the love I have, it is not enough. You will one day stand before a holy God, and you will do so either by your own name or under the name of Jesus. And if you insist on coming in your own name, you will suffer the endless, unimaginable disgrace of having all the secrets of your heart laid bare before him, a nakedness that you could never taste or experience in this life. You think public speaking is scary? It's nothing compared to being before a holy God. There's no need to experience that. No need to experience that. Jesus Christ has offered to every single person, receive my sacrifice on your behalf. Receive my righteousness instead of holding your wickedness. Have forgiveness, covering, and cleansing. Please come to him today. If you have friends that you came with, talk to them. Pastor Greg will be here praying after the service. For the rest of us, brothers and sisters, Jesus is reversing the curse of Babel, as we heard about already today. We find proof of this in the book of Acts, which was read, where the group that gathers at Pentecost, having different languages, are ministered to supernaturally by the apostles, who are given the power to overcome the curse of Babel, speaking of the mighty works of God and all to all the nations and language gathered there. And we see it in this room. Yes, we sing in English, that's true, but we have people from every tribe, tongue, not every, many tribe, tongues, and languages. So if we can see it happening today, it's one of the reasons we come to church, because we get to see that God's promises are being cared for, are being sustained. Please hold fast your hope. He is coming to finish the work he started, to heal all the pain, to fulfill every longing. We're going to continue to talk about this in a moment as we take communion. Pray with me. Father, thank you. Thank you for showing us in so many different ways, in so many different times, that you are working. You have not stopped working since the fall. You have continued to care for your promise. Yes, you have concealed it at times. You have allowed the raging of the nations to obscure the promise of the gospel, the promise of the seed. But you have preserved it and you have protected it until Jesus is coming. And you have preserved it and protected it through the ages to bring us here. And you will preserve it and protect it until you come again. Please fill us with hope today, Father. We cannot stir this in our own hearts. It has to be your work. Please do this, we ask in Jesus' name.